And so that's what I planted in 2024 in spring and through summer. It was 1,000 raspberry plants, 1,000 asparagus plants in
Wow.
seven rows. And I'm taking the approach of doing it as a permaculture trial because I just don't want to be monocropping, with perennials. I want to actually, try permaculture in these rows. And so I've done things like plant strawberries at the ground cover level for underneath my asparagus and underneath my raspberries.
Welcome to Thrive in the Future podcast, positive solutions to help you thrive, designing your intentional life, homesteading, gardening, and rediscovering culture and tradition. At Grow Nut Trees, it's time to plan for spring. I have elderberry cuttings and comfrey cuttings, as well as elderberry crowns available. And new this year are mulberry cuttings, and I'm working on getting some willow cuttings that'll be added pretty soon. In addition to that, I have new chestnuts, Qing chestnuts, that's spelled Q-I-N-G, and this is a half-sib Chinese chestnut. So what does that mean? There is one really famous chestnut tree. So a half-sib means that it was grown from seed that came from that tree, open-pollinated with other trees, usually hybrid chestnuts, not just Chinese chestnuts. These Qing chestnuts are grown local. I don't have very many of them, so jump on them right away. That's at grownuttrees.com.
Okay, welcome back to Thrive in the Future. This week I have Graham Towerton with me from Permaculture Canada. Welcome, Graham.
Thanks very much, Scott. Appreciate the opportunity.
Sure, thanks for coming on. So what's new in Michigan?
Well, we haven't had much snow here. It's been pretty warm, all things considered. The soil is only just frozen in the last week. Ordinarily, I'd be anticipating my first frost in the middle of October. That happened, but then it warmed up after that, and my soil never really quite froze until just recently. And so we've been doing a lot of work on the farm. When I say we, during 2024, I've had the privilege of hiring my first intern, who's now my first full-time farm manager.
Wow.
And so, that gives me a lot more capability of getting a lot more work done. So I'm very happy to mention Julia Fouty as my intern. She's permaculture design certified from Midwest Permaculture. Came up here in June to visit with me just to see if I had some work that she could do here. So we interviewed for a day, and then she came up for a week just to see what it would be like. And then she came up for 2 weeks, and then she decided she'd come up permanently. And we've been hosting her here in our tiny house on site. So she's a live-in farm manager for me, and it's made a tremendous difference to what I can get done here.
Wow. How big's your farm up there?
Well, so we started out at 2.3 acres.
Really?
So a little bit of history about how I purchased the place. So 2014, we moved up here from Texas, and I moved up here to be the general manager of a biodiesel plant that's here in town. And in any event, we purchased 2.3 acres, the original 1850 farmhouse, all built out of brick, and all of the dairy barns and workshops and everything on that 2.3 acres. And we purchased it for the princely sum of $80,000. And,
Wow.
we kind of lucked into it. When I first, contacted the realtor, he said that they had three offers. And then once people had inspected it and realized how old it was, all the offers were rescinded. So I walked in and did my inspections and made a cash offer for it. And, so that was in 2014. And, it was basically surrounded by 157 acres of corn and soy wheat rotation. And the 2.3 acres that we have with all of what used to be the dairy operation for a combined grain and dairy feed operation. So then fast forward to 2022, and we're in California from 2018 to 2020, and we learned that there was a solar farm that was going to come to town and develop the property around us. And they contacted me in 22 to basically say, hey, what would you like in order to be a really happy neighbor? And so I said, I'd really like to have some fencing materials so that I can screen out some of the view places, to not see the solar farm every moment. They gave me that. And then I asked for some solar cells to put on my barn. They couldn't give me those because they had a fixed lot coming from China for their panels and didn't have any left over, after their maintenance needs for the next 30 years. So they gave me some cash instead for that. And then I said, well, what I'd really like to be really happy is if you could give me 4.6 acres and land, 5 acres of land and square me off, because I'd been keyholed from the front street with all the land around me, and it was just surrounded by farmland. And so what I said, if I could have the land to the east given to me so that I can then expand my farming operations and actually have some dirt to play with, because most of my land that I had with the 2.3 acres was sitting under concrete and buildings.
Right.
And so they said, well, why would we give it to you? And I said, well, you can't put any solar panels on it, so you're not going to have any income for the next 30 years, and you're going to be paying property taxes at your new rate for 30 years with no income. So I said, I'll take that burden from you. And the guy, the CEO of the company, he said, that's an accountant's dream. So they gave me the deed for that in December of 2023 for 4.6 acres. So I took over the management of that land then pretty much as soon as I knew that they were going to give it to me. So in September, I started, plowing up rows for planting asparagus and raspberries. And so that's what I planted in 2024 in spring and through summer. Mm-hmm. It was 1,000 raspberry plants, 1,000 asparagus plants in
wow.
seven rows. And I'm taking the approach of doing it as a permaculture trial, because I just don't want to be monocropping, with perennials. I want to actually, try permaculture in these rows. And so I've done things like plant strawberries at the ground cover level for underneath my asparagus and underneath my raspberries,
mm-hmm.
Because those are both pretty much vertical crops, right? And so then I've interplanted, down the center of the rows, I've got peach trees on 10-foot centers. I've got comfrey in the center of the rows. I've got catmint in the center of the rows, et cetera. So I'm trying to do a permaculture trial so I can demonstrate, hey, you can do this and also do it in a commercial fashion. And I've made these rows 150 feet long. I know how many plants are in each one, so I can then, once I start producing, I can, determine what my yields are and calculate and show what the profitability is, for my 1,000 raspberry plants, my 1,000 asparagus plants, and whatever other yields that I get from everything else that's going to be in those rows, whether it's strawberries, I've got garlic in there, I've got lavender, all kinds of other different things in there. So that's really all that started in 2024, was all of that premised upon the land that I got given to me and took the deed in December of 2023.
Goodness.
And then to add further progress, I guess, reports on the land. About 2 months ago, the same solar farm folks contacted me and asked me if I could manage all of the buffer zones around the outside of their fence on the two sections of land that they've got. And that works out being about 40 acres.
Wow.
And they've basically told me that if I can manage the vegetation so that they don't get any pressure from the county or the township for having weeds growing everywhere, then I can plant whatever I want as long as I don't shade the solar panels.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certain setback requirements they've got for based on, the heights of the trees, So with the chestnuts that you've sent me the seed for, if I plant a chestnut out there and let's say it could get to 80 feet tall by the time it's mature, I have to be 240 feet back away from the nearest panel so that I don't get any shading. But they'll let me plant whatever I want on the south side of the field because the orientation of the panels, is they rotate from east to west with the sun and they don't care about any shading from the south. So,
really, they don't care about any shading from the south?
No, they don't, because in the wintertime, those trees will lose their leaves. I'm not going to plant any 80-foot evergreens or anything like that. They just don't exist right here. So in any event, I've got this now, what's essentially 45 acres of land that I can play with here, hopefully in the next 30 years. So what are my goals for 2025? that's a how long is a piece of string question for me at the moment, because I'm trying to figure out first how to get all of the resources that I need to manage that land effectively.
Mm-hmm.
How to get all the people that I need to help, because Julia and I have already recognized that, despite the fact there's now two of us working on this, that the work list, is still beyond two of us.
Sure.
And then continuing on with the theme of these permaculture trials that I'm doing with the raspberries and the asparagus, what else can I plant in there? And progressively planting out the 4.6 acres that I got in December 2023. So flipping back to 2024, what's been done so far, I've probably planted 400 or 500 trees so far around the property. Lots of seedling trees from Arbor Day Foundation for evergreens and stuff to create some snow barriers, trying to create a few wildlife corridors as well. I've got a creek to my east, just off the east side of the land that I just acquired, and so the deer tend to run right through my raspberry patch and my asparagus patch every night. So I'm trying to create a bit of a corridor to direct them down to the water and along the creek instead of through my property and let them go through the neighbor's soybean field instead. So I planted a bunch of trees and raspberry bushes, like the wild raspberries, that kind of stuff along, that corridor to try to, direct traffic, so to speak, for the deer. So that and planting, 300 lavender plants I think I've got in the ground this year, or in 2024. A ton of strawberries that I transplanted. The raspberries and asparagus that I mentioned, there's probably out of that, 400 or 500 trees, there's probably about 100 fruit trees I put in the ground as well. And then, as I mentioned, I bought, I forget how many it was now. It was a couple hundred chestnuts from you as seed. So, funny story that, I shared with you through Telegram, I think it was, that, I lost, or on Facebook perhaps, but I lost some of those. Well, they're not lost, but they're just not where I know where they're at. The squirrels... Squirrels got into my pot and dug up, one of the pots and have probably buried them out in the field somewhere, but I'll find them hopefully in the spring when they all come up. So one of the things that, I've always liked, the chestnut tree, it's always been something that I was, a little bit saddened about when I first came here and learned about, the blight that had wiped out, the American chestnuts. And, so the fact that you've got chestnut seed and, I can grow them here in Michigan, it's like it was too easy for me to get a couple hundred of them from you and put them in the ground. If I only get 50 of them to come up, that's more than I've ever seen in my life. So, I'll plant those out most likely in that east field, as part of that wildlife corridor. And, my grandkids will get to enjoy those when they reach maturity.
No, yeah, that's great. Wow. Yeah, I'm gung-ho on those chestnut varieties that that I got in the fall. I'm really excited about it. I went down to Charlie's Chestnuts. I think I told you this story, but I was working on my permaculture design implementation, ran out of time. My excavator job turned into 2 days, but they had a U-pick down at the chestnut farm, and it was an opportunity to get seed with that's not treated, because usually they treat them and then sell them to the store, and you can't get them otherwise. So I went down there, and they remembered me because I had talked to them by email, and I arrived with 15 minutes left of the day. And then Charlie's wife said, "Hey, you need to meet Charlie," and he gave me a guided tour of the orchard. And he said, "Yeah, you want to pick this up. You want to pick this up." And this was late season, so most of them were the hybrids, know, and not just the Chinese chestnuts. So, and they were huge. Those ones that I've had pictures of, that the what are they revival that are almost as big as my palm.
Yeah, exactly. Those were massive. I couldn't believe how big. The ones that, the few that you sent over to me just to try out. I'm like, my gosh, they're the biggest chestnuts I think I've ever seen.
Yeah, I spent so much time talking that I didn't pick up enough chestnuts.
But fair enough, right? Because, I mean, he's part of the local scenery, I guess, as an expert in chestnuts, correct?
Yeah, and then what he said was that that people are asking him for chestnut trees and seedlings all the time, but he got into some argument because he's only organic, and he got into an argument with the state because you have to have a live plant license. And they told him that if he had that, he had to spray them. And I think they meant if you're going to send them out of state, then you have to spray them and stuff. So then he said, "Hey, I'll just send them to you because you're growing them in mostly in pots.
Yep.
When I grow them in the ground, I can't get them out of the, I have too much clay soil, even if I put a whole lot of compost in. And if I dig them up, the taproot gets just disturbed too much.
Yep.
So I've been growing them in, either raised beds that I have air, air gapped or air pruned, or just plain old pots and buckets. So
Yeah, so I mean, following your lead, then, one of the things I'd like to do is sell, chestnut seedlings. I had the dickens of a time trying to get hold of chestnut trees, in the Midwest. And, the one that I did get was a Chinese chestnut from the local nursery. I managed to pick one up that, it was on sale at the end of the season. I got it for $60, and it was 2 feet tall. And, so for me, that's an expensive tree. And, then I realized, oh gosh, I needed two of them so that they could cross-pollinate. And I never got a second one at this point. So, with my work, in permaculture and, the properties that I'm doing work on, quite a number of chestnuts have been designed into the properties that I've been working on as the installer. And so, I need to have those available just so I'm not spending, like I said, that tree was on sale. It was 50% off. So ordinarily that 2 foot tall tree would cost me $120. And so if I've got then hybrid chestnuts available, courtesy of your seed, and then able to create seedlings, I think I can plant them here and dig them up because I'm really sandy soil. And I can't even hold water for a pond or anything here because of how sandy it is. I'm right at the edge of, where the glaciers, sort of stop their, southward push. And so I've got, just a tremendous amount of sand. I think, I can grow a lot of different trees and put them in the ground and then dig them up a year later or 2 years later as seedlings. So.
That's cool. Yeah, I think there's a quarantine where you can't send chestnut trees to Michigan.
Correct. And that's the problem, right? So I have to find a supplier in Michigan, in order to avoid that quarantine issue. So for whatever reason it is, and I've never truly discovered the reason, though I've looked far and wide within the, Michigan Department of Agriculture to find out what the logic is. I don't know if it's just a hangover from the chestnut blight, that they don't want to have the disease risk in here. We've got other vague things that occur here where we can't grow black currants in Michigan because they are a host for the white pine blister rust that could destroy the pine trees that are used for producing all the paper here in Michigan. So, that one makes sense to me that, they want to try to control the white pine blister rust. But with the chestnuts, I've not really understood. But yeah, it's funny, every time I've tried to buy a chestnut, I'll play dumb a little bit, with the nursery that, I'm trying to buy it from. And there's been a couple of them, Rain Tree Nursery out in the Pacific Northwest that say, hey, look, we just can't ship it to you. We'd like to, but we can't. I did actually find, and I won't name them, but a nice little permaculture nursery in upstate New York that actually did ship me 10 chestnut seedlings, bare root. So I got those in the ground this year. And I'll hopefully have, I don't know, 10 years from now, maybe start getting a crop. I got no idea how long it really takes to start producing chestnuts in any quantity.
Takes, yeah, 5 to 10 years. The first ones will come up at 5. One of the things I've been reading about a lot over the last month is the those extra micronutrients that boron especially is important. And so I'm going to try some of that this year and mix in some boron and some other things. Some people actually use orchid fertilizer because it's got boron and it's, chestnuts need a acidic soil, and I don't have acidic soil, so it's and some people fertilize it with that. But I read at the Michigan State University that most of the chestnut trees in Michigan are colossal, which are pollen sterile because they're the ones that are really big, and then they fertilize them, or I mean pollinate them with the with a couple of French European varieties. So,
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting. Talk about boron real quick. I was out in California working on fertilizers for all of the tree and nut crops all up and down the San Joaquin Valley.
Oh, really?
So yeah, that's what I actually did was I worked in the lab formulating products so that they could remain liquid and be injected into fertigation systems where it goes out with irrigation water for all these different crops. So in the San Joaquin Valley, I mean, almonds are a real obvious one, right? We're the largest producer of almonds in the world, and most of it's grown in California. But there's pistachios, there are chestnuts, there are, walnuts, there's avocados, there's all the citrus crops, there's grapes, figs, you name it. It grows in the San Joaquin Valley. And so, the company I was working for was fertilizing, somewhere between 5 and 10,000 acres at a time, where we'd deliver bulk tanker trucks of liquid fertilizer, stick them in a tank, and then, drip feed them out with irrigation water. So most crops actually have a certain amount of requirements for boron, and nut crops, I think, are up there, with needing it. And so a little bit goes a long way. And just to talk about what kind of boron I used, I just used the same boron that's present in borax powder.
Yep, borax powder.
And it's the cheapest way to get hold of it. It really is.
So did you have to dissolve it in hot water and like they were talking about?
All that. So we had a blending company that we'd just deliver all the powders to for all the different, nutrients that we're putting in. So it was boron, it was zinc, it was manganese, it was cobalt, molybdenum, all those kinds of different things that are needed as trace elements, as well as the NPK, the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So my job was to basically get all of those things to be in the water at the same time. And that can be particularly challenging, when you've got, say, phosphoric acid as your source of phosphate, and then you've got potassium hydroxide as your source of potassium. You mix those two together, and you're getting this really nice, violent chemical fizzy reaction that was a lot of fun in the lab. But you don't want to have take place in a fertilizer tank or in the production facility. So, I had a lot of fun putting all those formulations together. And what I learned from that was, the science of agronomy and, all the nutritional requirements for all these different crops. And, most especially then the impact of pH on the solubility of all these different things and the availability of these for plants. And this is well before I, really started my formal permaculture training. But, the point being now is that, I've understood a lot more about, the mycorrhizal fungi connections in the soil, and how, that's responsible for delivering nutrition to the roots of the plants. And what I'm finding now is that most of the work that I did out in California was just basically to saturate the soil with fertilizers because that was the only way to get it to the roots of the plants. I mean, most of the soil out there is sterile, from a microbiological standpoint. And, so you're basically trying to get the stuff into the soil, but not have it all go straight through the root zone and end up in the water table. So it's a fine line for trying to treat it that way. So now, obviously, very different approach on my farm. My fertilizer usage over the last 10 years has been exactly 0 pounds of all those different micronutrients that you want to talk about, because I'm basically taking plant materials and, creating my own compost and using that for fertilizer.
That's
So,
great.
and to me, that's the way that it ought to be done, from a permaculture perspective or regenerative agriculture perspective, as opposed to commercial, conventional agriculture. And it's certainly a heck of a lot cheaper. If I'm just using wood chips and leaves, from the local community to create, the source of all my plant nutrition, it's all that stuff breaks down. I mean, you think about what goes into making up an oak tree or a maple tree. When that all decomposes, it's going to feed all my plants. And I've got the proof of that now for over 10 years, where I haven't needed to use anything except chicken manure to complement, the wood chips and the leaves. So.
That's great. So the asparagus you had, like Mark Shepard was saying, that you have to, it's really dependent on manganese and or magnesium and calcium, but only some types can get absorbed. Did you augment any of that when you planted your asparagus?
I haven't on the new stuff, because it was so small. You know, these asparagus plants, these 1 year crowns, I mean, you know, it
Yeah, they're
comes up
small.
like a pencil lead in
Right.
thickness, you know, with the first fern. So I haven't done any additional fertility on those, but the interesting part is I've got asparagus on my property that's been here since I purchased it. It was planted by the prior owners. I got no idea how old it was, but the stuff's coming up as thick as my thumb and a couple stalks as thick as two thumbs coming up each year in the spring.
Wow.
And I've not needed to do anything with those except my natural fertility program. I've dug up those crowns and done crown divisions and stuff in order to propagate them out to different places on my property. And I'll just give them a dose of my leaf compost, you know, which has got the chicken manure in it for the nitrogen, but it's also rich in phosphorus and potassium. And so I'm finding that I haven't had any problems at all, other than, you know, the year that I put that on, I got such rapid growth. It wanted to just grow straight to fern, you know, because probably how much nitrogen was in there. It's just creating leafy growth as opposed to, you know, just the stalks for harvest. So I have to be very careful about applying it to not get that accelerated growth. And that's the beauty of compost, right? It's not so strong that you're just going to get, you know, rapid growth like you would if you just went out with urea or something like that. So,
Sure.
yeah, I go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, as I can say, you know, my fertilizer program for the property is driven by my chickens. You know, so
That's awesome.
we'll go out and collect the leaves. So Julia and I, you know, took my trailer out. We go around and pick up 300, 400, 500 bags of leaves from the curb as the neighborhood puts them out. And I've got them all out in paper bags now as well. So, you know, keep those paper bags and use them for fire starters, you know, for my biochar facility, that kind of stuff. In any event, you know, we just pile all that stuff up and we'll let it rot. The chickens get out there, they'll scratch through it, they'll fertilize it, you know, and within the space of 2 years, it turns into, you know, black gold. It literally does. And then the same with the wood chips. I've got a part of my property that's right in front of the chicken coop that I bury with wood chips, probably 6 or 8 inches deep, whenever I can. And the chicken scraps, I mean, all the food scraps go out there, you know, all the leafy green material goes out there in the spring and the summer, and we just let the chickens have at it. And they're obviously, you know, fertilizing that land at the same time. And those wood chips I've found over the space of 2 years, they'll decompose, you know, to the point where I'll get like 4 or 5 inches of, you know, sort of black compost material underneath the wood chips every couple of years. I'll dig that up and just sift out the chunky bits of wood chip and then go put that on my gardens. You know, so there's the general caution with wood chips that, you know, the carbon to nitrogen ratio is too high. I don't have that problem because of all the nitrogen from the chicken manure, and the decomposition of all those leafy greens and stuff that takes place in that area. So I've found that compost that I dig up from underneath those wood chips is especially good for putting on my vegetable gardens. I'll put probably 2 or 3 inches on each vegetable garden every couple of years, around my fruit trees, that kind of stuff. And, you know, so literally chicken manure, wood chips, and leaves are the source of all my fertility on my property.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, and if you dig, yeah, everybody says, oh, you shouldn't use wood chips because it's going to suck nitrogen out of the soil. You're taking care of that. Plus, you're digging down into that lower layer, right?
Exactly.
That's cool.
And, you know, I've also got the proof. You know, so that new field that I got in December of 2023, the one row that I started to mulch the pathway so that I could control, you know, the grass and weed growth, you know, that was coming up after the farmer, you know, left the field. And so I mulched about 30 feet of one row, you know, with a load of wood chips that I got. And stopped after that because I ran out of wood chips until there was another load came, and I never got back to finishing that row out. But I did plant the row, and I planted the peach trees, like I said, on 10-foot centers, comfrey in between, catmint, some thornless blackberries along the outside edges, strawberries, etc. And I had mulched half of that in the row itself, you know, so around all those plants, I'd also put in the wood chips. And I've got this one video that I produced late in summer of this year to of 2024 to show the difference between the areas where I had mulched just the pathways and the areas where I had mulched in the row as well, and the areas where no mulching occurred at all. You know, and I've got it all in the same row.
Wow.
So I feel like it's a good comparison. But in August, I went out there and I dug into the mulch in the areas in the garden part and mm-hmm. under the path. I've already got mycorrhizal fungi formation taking place, you know, because that's coming in with the wood chips.
Sure.
And so the soil was moist and cool and soft underneath those wood chips.
Mm-hmm.
And as I moved down the road to the part where I had mulched the path only, but the soil in the garden was exposed still, you know, it was drier and harder. And when I went further down the road to where no mulching took place, I mean, it was like a desert. You know, it was just hard packed, compacted. It was like the original farm soil. Mm-hmm. And so that was the proof that I needed to say, hey, look, mulching works, and I don't give a tinker's cuss about what the nitrogen content is in my mulch. The plants that were fully mulched were twice the height of the ones where I hadn't mulched in the garden. So like my peach trees were literally 3 feet tall, and these are peach seedlings that I've grown from seed from under my other peach trees. I put them in, they're also like 12, 14 inch tall single stick seedlings.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that were fully mulched were 3 foot tall in one season. As I went further down the row, I've still got just like single sticks, you know, at the back end of the row where no mulching took place. So I don't feel like I've lost fertility as a result of using wood chip as a mulch in any fashion. I think I've gained it, you know, and I think most of it is that conservation of moisture enables my plants to survive through what's been a very, very dry year in 2024 for us. I mean, summer we had 8 weeks with maybe an inch of rain.
Yeah.
You know, ordinarily, we'd get, you know, 3 inches a month.
Mm.
So, you know, I feel like I've proven the point for myself, and, you know, I've got the video footage that I put together for it. And I think one of my Instagram posts, you know, from back in August has it. But in any event, you know, that mulching works for me. It doesn't matter where I am in the world. I mean, I learned to mulch in Australia because of how dry it is. You know, place where I lived last in Australia, we'd get 6 inches of rainfall a year. So if you didn't mulch, you had no moisture in the soil.
Sure.
And so, you know, that's a habit that I've continued here, and it works for me, and I don't see the loss in fertility that most people talk about. So,
well, that's great. Yeah, I have to mulch everything with wood chips just because it just dries out. We get no April showers bring me flowers. We get dry all the way up to May, and then we get torrential thunderstorms and drought in between. So, and this year it rained all the way up to July 4th, and then it was super drought after that. So it was really weird, and everything had a ton of growth, and then it wasn't able to sustain that growth in the latter half of the summer.
Yeah, that's pretty much the same that we've had here in Michigan, you know, southern Michigan. And, you know, while it's a good 10-hour drive from my place to your place, you know, the climate's been largely the same this year between the two states.
Yeah, so Iowa and Kansas have been really similar also, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, for me, you know, the proof, again, of why I mulch and, you know, the benefit is that when that rain does come, it's actually soaking into my soil because I've got now – you know, all of the soil is opened up. It's not hard baked in the sun anymore. You know, so in all of the areas where I've mulched, you know, there's ample moisture still in the soil all the way through the year. I put together about a 3,000 square foot food forest in front of my house on my front lawn. I started mulching that in August of 2023 and then planted in spring of 2024. In that with probably, I don't know, three apples, three pears, you know, three peaches, a bunch of lavender, some azaleas and all kinds of different stuff in there just because I wanted to make it pretty and get rid of my front lawn.
Yeah, I hate lawn.
Yeah, passionately hate lawn. You know, and so I've got probably about a quarter to half an acre of it, you know, in front of my house to the road, and I'm just burying it in wood chips as the guys deliver some more to me and planting fruit trees and stuff in it. But in any event, you know, just with one season, you know, I put 12 inches of wood chips out there And I've never needed to irrigate any of that at all, never watered any of it except for the days where I planted the trees. And, I'd put a 5 gallon bucket of water on each of them as I plant them. And that's all the water I've given them. But, again, that proof for me is that all those trees are super healthy. They all put on, really fantastic growth. And even despite the fact that we had very little rain, like you said, from July 4th onwards, all the way through to September before we kind of got any good, decent rain, those trees have thrived.
That's great. Wow. So your raspberries, what kind of raspberries did you plant?
They were the heirloom variety called Boyne. So I purchased my stock from Norse Farms. I think they're up in the northeast in Maine, I think. But in any event, when you purchase 1,000 raspberries, the price comes down dramatically. So I paid $1.52 a stick for those, and they're like probably 2 or 3 year old canes, 2 year old canes, and so they're quite robust. And apparently they produce abundantly. I'm going to find that out here in the coming spring. My first year worth of growth wasn't really wonderful because of how dry it was. So that was a real struggle. I'm
Are
going to
they
say
thornless?
they're not thornless. No, they've got what I'd say bristly
Yeah,
canes on
bristly
them.
thorns, yeah.
So the variety called Heritage has been one of my favorites. It's another heirloom variety. And, I've grown those for my customers here. I planted five of those 2 years ago for a customer up in Pinckney. And this year she begged me to dig out all the suckers that had come up. And we pulled over 300 plants out of the same spot where I planted five. And, we've used those for other customers, planted them back in my own fields, et cetera. But she harvested, I'm going to say 3 or 4 gallons for each of those like clumps of, five raspberries. And she said she'd made every single raspberry product that she possibly could. The kids would eat them fresh every day. When Julia and I went there to dig those canes out, I think we gorged ourselves for about 3 hours on raspberries and felt like we hadn't even touched the sides of what was still left on the vines in September. So those particular varieties are the ones that produce a long crop through the year. So you'll get your spring growth of your new canes, and you'll get those producing late towards fall. But then you'll have the prior year's canes, the second year canes that start producing first thing in the spring and go all the way through the summer. So I got to say, when I first planted that heritage variety here, the first year we picked from June all the way through to November, we were picking raspberries. And I've still got those ones on site. I've got those underneath my two original peach trees. And again, this year, even as dry as it was, we're still picking raspberries all the way through into November. So it's one of my favorite crops. They're super sweet. I'm a
Oh, that's
sucker for
great.
eating them all out in the field. They don't make it into the kitchen very often.
Yeah, I planted two thorny blackberries like 3 years ago, and then they took off and turned into a huge thicket, and I've been warring against them ever since. I don't think I got any blackberries out of them. They just are vegetative growth. So I'm having to nuke them out or put billboard fabric around them or on top of them to try and get them to slow down.
One of the other ones that I've got on site then is the wild black raspberry. It probably has a fruit that's maybe the size of a nickel.
Really?
And I've had that come up wild on my place just from birds that have, dropped the seeds down on the ground along a fence row. The one mother plant that came up there in that food forest was 2016 is when it first got noticeable there. We picked about 5 gallons off it this year. And then I've probably transplanted out now over 200 other canes from that one. Out into my field. And so when I mentioned that corridor that I'm creating for the wildlife, I'm using the raspberries, in between the trees to help create that corridor.
Sure.
And they're thorny as all get out. You know, they're the type that, you know, will put their cane back into the ground and then another one will come up and they'll keep spreading that way. I'm using that to my advantage to basically create a hedgerow or a thicket with those so I can try to keep the deer out of my field.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I've got both blackberries and goji berries that do that. And they come over and they touch the ground and then go run about. And then I think I turned 3 goji berries into, and I dug up 30 plants last year in 2023.
Oh, wow.
And that started as 3. And so, yeah.
Yeah, gojis are pretty good like that. I got given 3 little canes by one of our Hispanic friends that's here in town. And, you know, I'd never tried them before. I'd bought some dried ones before as a packet. And, you know, they seem better when they're dried to me to taste.
Yeah.
The fruit can be a little bit of a bitter aftertaste when it's fresh that I don't quite agree with. But in any event, I like them just because they do produce abundantly. You know, with no care whatsoever, you're going to get a crop of goji berries.
Right.
And, you know, they're a good hedgerow plant as well. You know, so mine are in the bottom of my food forest, in what we call our tiny forest between two of my barns. And I've probably got 20 or 30 plants out there right now that I need to dig up and start moving here in the spring. So.
Yeah, I'm going to start using the also filling in the different. So the raspberries come up earlier. The blackberries tend to come up earlier. Strawberries, of course. And then I've got bush cherries that fill that gap in May and June.
Yeah.
So, and then I'm wanting to spread those out a little bit more too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's for me, I guess, is the strategy now is it's trying to get stuff to produce all the way across the year. So probably for me, my first thing that, I mean, I start getting arugula, believe it or not, is my first crop every year. I've got a perennial arugula. It's called the olive leaf type.
Really?
It's a complete different scientific name compared to your, I think it's Erica Sativa is your arugula that you buy in the grocery store. Any event, I've got this stuff. It self seeds. It grows back from the roots. I mean, I can literally mow it down to the ground, you know, at this time of the year, and it's going to be twice as big next year. I'll dig the stuff up, break the tap root, doesn't matter, plant it again, and it keeps growing back. So nothing touches it from a wildlife perspective. So it's another one for me to stick as a barrier plant, you know, in amongst my fruit trees and stuff like that. It's a type of mustard, you know, as all sure. rocket is. And so, you know, none of the wildlife tends to eat too much of it. My chickens will eat it if they're super hungry, but they don't often get super hungry. So, you know, I don't have any problem with anything eating the rocket or the arugula, just our family members. And so in any event, there's that comes up first. Then probably next is my strawberry crop. You know, so I've got a bit of a gap between when the arugula starts to show itself, which can be as early as April. My asparagus is being quite variable depending on the how warm the winter is and the spring is. You know, so I've had in the 10 years that I've been here, that existing asparagus that was on the property has started to come up as late as June or as early as April. So my asparagus crop was actually finished this year in May because of how warm it was that we had during our winter. So we had a situation where we had a 70-degree day in February with a really, really warm week of like 50 to 60-degree weather.
Yeah.
And that brought all of my trees into early bud break and blooming, you know, and then followed up with hard freezes all the way through April. Pretty much killed all my tree crops. So I think, was it 2 years ago, I harvested 200 pounds of peaches off 2 trees. I've got 6 apple trees in my orchard. And the same year we had like, the next year we had 500 pounds of apples off 5 or 6 trees. I could count the peaches on both my trees this year on the fingers of my hand.
Wow.
I got no apples. I got 7 cherries off 2 trees. I got no plums. I got maybe half a dozen pears, and the groundhogs beat me to those. They climb the trees, the dang things, and eat the fruit, believe it or not.
Really?
So the only thing that did really well for me this year was mulberries and strawberries and blueberries and blackberries and raspberries. All my berry crops seem to be okay. And I think it's just because most of those are, woody canes and whatever, and maybe they just don't break bud that early, or because they're closer to the ground, perhaps it wasn't as warm there. So in any event, that was all I got this year. So I'm now looking to, try to, fill in the gaps first, between different crops that I harvest, and then also try to create a little bit more resilience for what happens with these funky springs that we can get here. And I'm sure you've got the same problem in Kansas, that depending on whether you've got warm weather coming up from the Gulf up through Texas, or whether you've got cold weather coming down from Canada, it can change dramatically your spring season for you.
Yeah, 2020 and 2021, we got frost in May, which is unheard of. And then, because the last normal frost is April 20th. And then 2023, everything budded out early. And then we got late frost, and all of the apples and all of the chestnuts were lost. And I had apples on one side of the tree because I had my apple trees in a microclimate. So, and then this year wasn't bad. It had just got past that by the time we had our normal frost right on the April 20th, but it had already passed. It had enough of the blossoms were already done. We weren't a complete loss, but the apples didn't look great. They all kind of looked kind of misshapen and stuff. Probably because of that all drop off of rain in July.
That'll do it for sure. So it was a challenging year, 2024, in terms of harvest, and thankful, for the prior year harvest of apples and peaches that we had, because we still had a lot of those products in the freezer from the prior years, believe it or not. So we had taken those 200 pounds of peaches and, turned them into peach cobbler and peach pie and every kind of peach thing that we could put in the freezer, and did that. And with the apples the following year, we did the same thing. And so we still, believe it or not, have apple cake in the freezer from our 2022 harvest. And it still tastes just as good. We've actually had people beg us to sell it to them because they like it. We put so much apple in it that it's just super moist. And so in any event, we're thankful that we're able to put all that stuff in the freezer, because the next 2 years, were pretty challenging for us in terms of the different crops. And you have the situation, I think, with a lot of the fruit trees where it's kind of on for a year and off for a year anyway. And so for us, it was just compounded by the, the early warm weather and the late freezes. And so I'm hopeful we don't have it for three in a row where we have that problem. Otherwise, I might not be farming much longer.
Do you have pawpaws up there that far north?
I do. I've got two of them that I planted. So that tiny forest that I've got where our tiny house is, where Julia lives, I planted two pawpaw seedlings there in 2016. They're now about 9 or 10 feet tall. And so technically, I guess that makes them 8 years old. I'm hopeful of seeing them flower maybe this year coming. I've got some folks that I've spoken to are growing pawpaws over in the Akron area in Ohio. And they had no fruit whatsoever for 7 years, to the point where they're ready to think about chopping out their pawpaw trees. And then all of a sudden they got like 300 pounds of pawpaws in the first year. Off three or four trees. So, I'm hopeful that this will be my year where I actually get to harvest a pawpaw. And I'm super excited when that happens. The pawpaw is the closest fruit that I can find to what is the tropical custard apple that my parents used to grow in Australia on our farm there. If you've ever eaten a custard apple, it is the most appropriately named fruit that I think has ever been given a name, because it tastes just like custard. And so, for me, the pawpaw being somewhat of a cousin to the custard apple, I'm looking forward to eating my first pawpaw off my own trees.
Yeah, that sounds good. All of mine are the wild variety, so they're kind of funky tasting, and then they won't grow out in the open. They only grow in the understory.
Yeah, and I've got minus understory. They are, the wilder variety. I've got in that food forest, we call the tiny forest. I put wood chips out there. It was my first place to use wood chip mulch on the property. And it was in 2016 we put that out there. And then 2017, I mentioned we moved across to California. So we come back in 2020. My two oldest kids were caretaking the house, and I use that term loosely because they weren't really taking care of it, but they certainly weren't taking care of the garden at all. But so I come back and take a look at that tiny forest that had just come up out of the wood chips. And I had two maple trees, a black locust, a bunch of elderberry, the wild raspberry, a bunch of mulberries had all come up just out of the wood chips. And the elderberries, we probably harvested, I don't know, 50 pounds of elderberries in the
Oh,
first
yeah.
year. Just a massive amount of production, and they keep spreading out. The black locust was already 25 feet tall when we came back in 2020, and it's now like close to 35 feet right now.
Wow.
I had a couple of wild Caleri pears come up. I've cut those out because they're one of my least favorite trees. They're super brittle, they break easily. So, in any event, I've actually planted my pawpaws in underneath my black locust and maple trees in the back end of that tiny forest.
Wow.
That's where I've got my goji, and the elderberry sits nicely in amongst that all as well. So it's super shaded there in the summertime. You can go sit there, and it's probably 10 degrees cooler in that tiny forest. And the pawpaws are doing fabulous, because they need that shade. So.
Yeah, that's great. Wow. Get me all excited. I get excited right after the winter solstice. The normies don't get excited until April, but
Yeah, I mean, Julia and I were walking around right rugged up outside. It's 15 degrees. Today was sunny, and so we're out there and we're just enjoying the sunshine, and it felt a lot warmer just because the sun was out. But we're like, when can we plant anything? And I'm like, Julia, it's January.
Yeah.
And our last frost is like 15th of May, so we're going to be doing a lot of work here in greenhouses. I've almost finished my first greenhouse for the second time. In any event, we'll close that in here probably in the next week or two. We got all the posts in, we got the roof and everything on, and I'm going to put some thermal mass water heat in there to, level out some of the colder temperatures in February. But I'm going to try to use that in March to start growing some of the vegetable seedlings that we want to put out. Julia wants to go straight from 0 to 100 miles an hour and planting everything she can, and I'm not going to discourage that for a second.
Sure.
So we're hoping to put a lot of vegetable seedlings together because, again, for the work that I do for my customers, they want their vegetable plants to complement the permaculture gardens that I've put together. So they're happy for me to come back and put all that stuff in the ground for them every spring, to plant their tomatoes and their peppers and beans and all that kind of stuff as well. So we're going to try to see if we can supplement our income by selling plants instead of buying them from the big box stores.
Yeah, that sounds good. So you put permaculture stuff along the outside of the gardens and then plant the annuals in the middle.
Yeah, well, somewhat a mix of both, right? So a lot of the places where I've done work, I've had to put up an 8 foot tall deer fence just to protect the garden, because people are pretty much in the woods. So you put that fence up, and according to the principles of permaculture and function stacking, is if I build a fence, and I'm going to grow everything that I can on it.
Right.
So I've put beans, the Kentucky Wonder Pole beans, I grow them up the fence. Cherry tomatoes, salad tomatoes, Roma tomatoes, all of those go on the fence. I've got grapes. I've got other, vining perennial crops on there as well. I'm probably going to put some hops on some people's fences because they like them. And so, I'll try to use that fence. And then what I'll do is I'll put, things like the raspberry canes at the bottom of that fence in the vegetable garden or the beds along the bottom of the fence,
Right.
blueberries, that kind of stuff. Then I've got bigger beds that I put together for then the staple crops like your squash, your corn, your potatoes, those kinds of things, which kind of sit in the center. And then I've got fruit trees then in amongst all of that with all of their support plants and stuff around it. So
Wow.
If folks are interested, they can go to my Instagram page. I'm just at Graham Towerton, and then you can see most of the permaculture work that I've done for my customers here in Michigan. You can see all that with the fences and everything else. So.
That's cool. Wow. That's great. So how can folks get a hold of you or contact you, Graham?
Yeah, so Permaculture Canada, we're permaculturecanada.world. So I'm the chief operations officer. Lindsay Brandon, I think you've had on your show as well, as the chief
Sure.
executive officer. So we work closely together. We got a lot of stuff that's coming up already. We're about to ship out to California to do some site visit and install work out there early this year, and hopefully supplement our winter income. And then we're headed to Florida in February. So if there are folks who are in Florida, want to get hold of us, we can come do site visits and do consultations. Probably the second and third week of February, we'll be down there. And then getting hold of us, just go to the website. You can make a booking there for a free consultation on that website. You can come to me at permacultureadventuresmi.com, permacultureadventuresmichigan.com. And I've also got, free 1 hour consultations up on the website right now. And we'd love to chat with anyone about what they'd like to do to start their journey or continue their journey with permaculture, regenerative agriculture. So we'll take all comers.
That's great. Excellent. Thank you, Graham.
You're very welcome. It's been
You
fun,
bet.
as always.
If you like this episode, leave us a tip on Venmo or Cash App at Thriving the Future, or join the Patreon, patreon.com/thrivingthefuture. You get early episodes and you get extras. Thank you. Check out Thriving News. That's where Perpin and I share longer form articles about homesteading, mindset, milpa gardening, food forest, etc. Go check it out at thrivingnews.com. Thank you for listening to the Thrive in the Future podcast. If you like what you hear, please click that like or subscribe button in your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Twitter at Thrive in the Fute, and also go to thrivingthefuture.com.